Welcome to the Writer Access Writer Podcast, bringing you new authors in one of today's hottest fields, content marketing. Here's your host, Writer Access founder and CEO, Byron White.
Welcome back, everyone. I'm here with Roger Dooley. Roger, welcome.
Hi, Byron. Happy to be here.
Right on. You're the author, of course, of Brain Fluence, 100 Ways to Persuade and Convince Consumers with Neuromarketing. But you have a new book coming out called The Persuasion Slide. Tell us a little bit about your new book and why you wrote it and what problem it's solving.
Okay, well, what I found is, first of all, in Brain Fluence, my first book, there are 100 short chapters, each with an idea of a strategy based on neuroscience or psychology that you can implement to market better. And what I've seen in the last few years is, not just from me, but from many other writers, a lot of advice based on things like cognitive biases, shielding these six principles of influence, and you can go on and on. There are so many tactics based on psychology and brain science, but it gets confusing for people when they have this tension between talking about their product and extolling its features, its benefits, the price, and so on, trying to incorporate all these other factors along with those sort of hard facts can be difficult. And what I found is that often various aspects are overlooked. And the persuasion slide is a really simple model that I created to sort of force people to think about those conscious and non-conscious factors involved in each step of the persuasion process. And I really wrote it first with online conversion in mind, things like converting people on a landing page to either buy a product or on an e-commerce site to not only put products in their cart, but to check out, and to generate leads, for example, on the web or on a mobile app. But it has application in other areas, too. I included an appendix of a couple of rather strange applications. One is getting people to continue taking their medications for the full course and how the same principles could be applied there, because that's a huge problem in the pharmaceutical industry. And the other was the college enrollment process, because these days colleges face a very difficult challenge ahead with declining population of traditional students, as well as increasing government regulation. Many schools are having difficulty either filling their classes or filling them with the students that they really want to have. And so I talk about, I show how my little slide model can be used in a process like that as well.
Neuroscience is a relatively new science, I guess you would say, and neuromarketing, I should say, is a relatively new science. How did you become introduced to neuromarketing and therefore choose to write a few books about it?
Right. Well, I guess I could date my interest in advertising back to my very early days. When I was in college, for some reason, I found myself fascinated by advertising. And when I was supposed to be studying organic chemistry and differential equations in the library, I'd be sneaking over the periodical section to read Ad Age. But the confluence of neuroscience and marketing dates back, at least for me, to about 2004. I began to hear people talking about applying neuroscience techniques like fMRI or EEG brainwave measurement to analyzing advertising. And they were calling this field neuromarketing and various other things. So I went out and I registered a domain. I was a digital marketer at the time. I still am to some degree. And I did what any self-respecting web guy would do. I bought a domain, neurosciencemarketing.com, and started creating some content there. And initially, I didn't know that this was going to become a huge interest of mine. I just thought, well, I've got this domain. I'll put some content there, and maybe it'll turn into something. Maybe it won't. But as I got more and more into it, I found that the field was really interesting and that a lot of people were not necessarily translating scientific findings into actionable business advice. And so I sort of changed my focus from this intersection of science and sort of hard analysis techniques, for instance, putting people in an fMRI machine and showing them ads to see what their brains were doing at the time, which is a technique that is really only accessible to big brands and, you know, very large companies because of the cost. And there's certainly some other techniques that aren't as expensive, but nevertheless, what I was looking for were techniques that could be translated into direct application by businesses of any size. So over time, I shifted my editorial focus from the sort of hard neuroscience tools, and I still talk about them occasionally, but more to actionable business advice.
Could you describe to the audience, and remember, we have a lot of writers listening in that create content for customers, whether it be copywriting or blog writing, articles, tech papers, white papers, you get the idea. Could you describe how some actual neuromarketing tactics and techniques that you both talk about in your various books and even in speaking engagements that you have, describe how neuromarketing is making its way to the marketplace?
Well, I guess one of the things that I bring up in many of my talks is an amazing study. Well, first of all, several amazing studies about the neuroscience of stories. And everybody knows that stories are a way of engaging readers. I mean, that's been known for decades and probably centuries or millennia if you go back to the earliest stories. But what they found with the advent of techniques like fMRI, where they can actually view almost in real time people's brain activity, is that when a person is listening to a story, the motor areas of their brain are activated as if they were performing the same actions that were included in the story. So it's a very impactful form of communicating. And the most amazing experiment used two fMRI machines. And this must have been a rather costly one because each machine costs a few million dollars. One subject in each machine, and one telling the other a story. And what they found was really amazing. They were monitoring both people's brains, and as the first one started telling the story, within seconds, the brain of the second one essentially synced up and showed the same areas being activated as the storyteller. So if you want to exercise mind control, this really shows that about the best way to do it is to tell somebody a story. And so, I mean, that's, to me, I think, one of those areas where people knew stories were important, but not necessarily how important or how effective they were. Something else that I think is really interesting from a writing standpoint and a neuroscience standpoint is the concept of a text metaphor. Now, if you heard somebody say, I had a difficult day or I had a rough day, you would say those statements are about the same. They mean the same thing, and neither conveys a lot more or a lot less emotion. But to the listener's brain or the reader's brain, there's a difference between those two, because rough actually has a sensory meaning as well, like rough sandpaper. And what they found when they studied people's brain activity is when they hear that a word like rough, that it actually lights up a separate area of the brain associated with touch. So even though it's being used in a context that is not sensory at all, you're simply describing what kind of a day you had, that sensory metaphor still comes through and lights up that area of the brain. So that's a very powerful tool, whether you're writing ad copy or even just trying to choose words that can be more impactful in something else.
I want to ask you about metaphors and taglines and why you think metaphors are surfacing as taglines for companies, and they have for many years. It's quite interesting when companies are literally, you know, drawing analogies to these very crisp, that major brands are building analogies. Let me read you a few taglines and see if you can guess who the big company is, just as an example. How about this one? Get a piece of the rock.
Oh, that would be Prudential Insurance.
Absolutely. You're in good hands.
Allstate.
Have it your way. That's a little old, but have it your way.
Well, that would be Burger King.
And then this is a tough one. Always there in a pinch.
Boy, that one I don't know. I don't.
I didn't think you would. Skoll.
Okay. Not a customer, I guess.
What can Brown do for you?
That's UPS.
Nice. How about Drivers Wanted? Also a little bit older, but.
Yeah, that's Drivers familiar,
Wanted.
But I don't know the brand.
VW.
Okay.
Where is the Beef? Final one. A little bit older as well.
Oh, well, yeah, I'm old, though, so that's okay. That's the Indies.
So, you know, it's wonderful. These are metaphors, you know, and these are large brand names associating their big company brand name with a metaphor. Is that interesting to you, and is that revealing to us?
Well, you know, I think whether or not a tagline is a metaphor, the key thing is that it has to resonate. I've spent some time as a sort of a critic of higher ed marketing, colleges and universities marketing, and many of them have these taglines that are completely interchangeable with each other. In other words, you could take, I'd have something like, you know, educate, inspire, innovate, or something as their tagline that provides no branding support at all for the their university. And you could plaster that on any other one, and nobody would notice. But when you have something that is like a where's the beef, now that could be used by anybody, but it has a particular resonance to it, and it implies something that is unique about our brand. It's suggesting that other brands don't have the beef and that our brand does. So I think that was powerful that way.
Mm-hmm.
Like the UPS, what can Brown do for you? That's kind of not really my favorite tagline, but it does relate to their signature color. So, and that's even a sensory word as well. You know, when you hear that, chances are your mind is somehow visualizing a picture of that brown UPS truck pulling up in front of your house. So I'll give them points for that, even if I don't care for the tagline that much.
Hmm. Is there some interesting history to metaphors that I'm remembering? I was a philosophy undergraduate major, but I remember John Locke thought that metaphors were the art of rhetoric, you know, and I think that maybe Thomas Hobbes called metaphors the abuses of speech. Philosophically, metaphors have had some interesting, sort of been like essentially contested concepts over the years. Have you studied that in your history of in your research for metaphors?
I haven't really studied
dug
that,
in there,
although
yeah.
I think that, you know, when you refer to rhetoric is all about persuasion. I think that people have known that metaphors are a shorthand method for communicating. And often, in part, what a metaphor is doing, it's sort of bypassing that cognitive part of your thought process and going straight into your brain. You know, the simpler the concept is, and the more powerful the metaphor is, you don't have to think about it. Now, one thing that I frequently write about, talk about, is Daniel Kahneman's split in our thought processes, which are system one and system two. And system one is a very fast way of thinking. His book is called Thinking Fast and Slow, which I highly recommend if any of your listeners haven't read it. But system one is fast, intuitive, emotional, it's rule-based, and it is very energy efficient for your brain. System two is what we think about when we talk about thinking through a problem. It's that sort of cognitive, rational, pluses and minuses, mental spreadsheet kind of thought process. And that is very energy intensive. Our brains do not want to use energy. They already use a greatly outsized proportion of our body's energy. So our brains are trying to operate as efficiently as possible. And if they can make a decision using system one, they'll do that. And when you are communicating with somebody and you're giving them a lot of facts and figures to buttress your case, you are forcing them into system two thinking, and that's going to be an uncomfortable state for them. And if you keep feeding them facts and figures, they're eventually going to tune out because it's just too much work to keep up with you. And metaphors, on the other hand, I think now this, I haven't necessarily seen the science on this, but I think what's happening is a metaphor is sort of avoiding that system two thinking and sliding more into system one thinking because it's already a familiar concept. Being a rule-based is one type of system one thinking, so that if you're making a decision on what product to buy in the store, if you see your favorite brand there, you don't have to think about it. Your past behavior has been, I bought this brand and it worked for me, so I can do the same thing again. You don't have to think about it. You don't have to read all the labels or compare the ingredients or anything else. You can just do it. And that makes your brain happy. And I think a metaphor is a little bit the same way. When you can compare a complex concept to something that your brain already is familiar with and knows how to deal with, then it just sort of slides right in.
No pun intended with the word slide.
Yeah, it's a slide down the brain. What can I say?
Let's go back to the slide. And by the way, thank you for that wonderful tangent that I sent you off there in the discussion metaphors. As you can tell, I'm really into metaphors, and I think they're powerful creatures. I was going to ask you about Zaltman. Let me ask you one more question about metaphors. Have you studied the Gerald Zaltman, the ZMAT technique?
Yeah,
method?
I've looked at it a little bit. I've read his book, and I actually quote him frequently. And my favorite quote of his is his split between conscious and non-conscious thinking. And he says that only 5% of our thought processes or decision processes are conscious and 95% are non-conscious. Mm-hmm. And you know, every scientist can come up with their own value, and you can never really prove one versus the other. But he has studied it long enough that I trust his judgment more or less, and it's the number that I use. And really what that's telling you, too, is that if you are totally focused on features and benefits and price or arguments that are based in logic and statistics, you're really only appealing to 5% of your target's brain. And that's why it's so important to deal with the rest of it with non-conscious appeals, emotional appeals, and so on. I know that he uses this sort of deep metaphor analysis for both interviewing. Rather than doing focus groups or surveys, which are pretty common market research tools, he just does this sort of in-depth psychoanalysis thing almost.
Yeah.
It's literally like going to a therapist, I guess.
Yeah.
Haven't been in one of the sessions, but it is designed to dig out these metaphors, and then it can be translated into something that could be made into the part of your marketing effort.
Totally. And just to talk about that for a second, and I want to ask you the question first, and then I'll tell you a little, I'll tell the audience about that. What do you think the power of images really are, in metaphoric images? So the whole ZMAT session thing, he's interviewed like 12,000 people, have gone through this ZMAT session thing for 100 clients in 30 countries. And he has this format, so you guys can tune into it listening in, that the attendees would basically be explained an assignment, and it would say, they would ask the participant to focus on a product section, like a sector, like kitchenware. And then before the next session, they were asked to go collect like 8 or 10 images that in some way represent their thoughts and attitude towards this sector. And the only instruction was the images have to be metaphorical rather than literal. So you can't show up with pictures of knives, right? So that was part of his analysis to what he was trying to tap into, the consumer's unconscious. So these images, they put all these collages together and try to analyze like what's going on in people's brains when they think of these sectors. Absolutely fascinating. So what is your take on that? That concept of imagery in the brain, and can imagery be triggered by both words when we read them and images when we see them?
Well, sure. I love really two parts of that. As far as the technique goes, I assume it's working for them. I've talked to the younger Zaltman as well, and they use this technique, and so it's working for them. It has not become widely adopted in the industry. There aren't a lot of other people doing this, so either the other companies lack the expertise or they prefer their own methodology. But as far as images, I think, of course, they're very powerful, and you can evoke imagery with words, particularly, you know, words that, well, we talked about that a minute ago, like sensory words or words that somehow imply an image that would cause them to sort of flash into your head. But then, of course, actually viewing images is great shorthand because, you know, imagine looking at an image that explains something versus reading a paragraph of text that has is supposed to have the same purpose. Clearly, the image is going to be processed much more quickly and pretty much goes straight into the viewer's brain. And, of course, you can create emotion with images. If you look at, a fashion magazine or something, there will be a ton of ads in there, and there will be essentially no text in those ads, no copy, no features, no benefits, nothing, except maybe the brand logo or the brand name and a very evocative image. And depending on what the model looks like, what the apparel looks like, the setting that they're in, whether it's black and white or color, all of this goes to create a particular emotion around the brand. And, you know, sometimes you look at it and say, wow, that is so bizarre. I can't imagine who would identify with this as yep. ad. But nevertheless, they are striving for a particular emotion that they could not achieve with words. I mean, yeah, they could write a short story and probably not have the emotional impact that that one image does.
Hmm. Have you read any of Jennifer Aker's work? She thinks she's out of the University of California on brand personality.
You know, I have not.
Yeah.
Or if I have, I don't recall it.
She's pretty interesting. She sort of taps into this, you know, I think it's five elements of brand personality: sincerity, excitement, competence, sophistication, and I think the last one's ruggedness. So she thinks that all brands across the world can fall into those one of those five areas, like Dodge truck falls in ruggedness. You know, she goes through this whole example sequence, but it's pretty cool. Sincerity, excitement, competence, and sophistication and ruggedness. Pretty cool. Do you think that brands have personalities in your mind? And do you think you would want to build your content and your copy and your content around the personality of a brand on the slide?
Well, I think they do. Yeah, well, I think brands definitely do have personalities, and it's important to be consistent. And now, whether Aker's division into five is correct, or if those are the only five, I can't really say. But I know that I recall when Hummer was still a brand that GM had and was promoting, they came out with a series of commercials about that were sort of eco-friendly Hummer commercials.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
to me, that was a total mismatch between what the brand image was, how people perceive the brand, and how they should have been marketing it. And instead, this was some sort of a weirdly apologetic type of ad to that I'm sure would not satisfy the eco types anyway, because a Hummer is still a Hummer. But instead of showing these like little forest glades and flowers and, you know, little ponds that were, it would have been much more effective to show, you know, Hummer blasting through 2 feet of mud or something.
Yeah, tough, strong, outdoorsy.
Coming over sand dunes.
Rugged, exactly.
And, well, go ahead.
Let's go back to the slide. So, sorry, thank you for that wonderful journey with us. Really great stuff. What about the slide? Well, tell us the elements of the slide and the persuasive slide and then how people slide down it.
Right. Well, in the context of a marketer, okay, they typically need to persuade somebody to either say buy a product or to give up their information so they become a lead. Those are some of the most common persuasion processes. And my work is based in part on the work of B.J. Fogg from Stanford, who created this Fogg behavior model that has this sort of complex little equation that I'm not going to recite for here. I'm sure if I could recite it exactly, but it involved the ability to do something, the motivation to do something, and then a trigger to make somebody do that, and that you could affect behavior change if those ingredients were in the right combination. And then he then expands that into this behavior grid that's like a 6x6 matrix that is really confusing for most mortals. What I was looking for was a way of incorporating some of that thinking and just trying to get marketers to think about both aspects and as they created each element of their marketing plan. And whether probably the purest example would be a landing page on a website, because typically you're measuring the conversion. So you've got great statistics. You know how many people arrive there, and you'll know how many people actually convert, whether they buy it or they give up their email address or whatever you want them to do. So that's sort of a very pure example. And you have to first align with your customer's gravity, which means you want to be sure that all of your messaging is aligned with what they came to you with. If you have a site that is about dieting, for example, your customers probably want to be healthier. They probably want to be more attractive. They may have even deeper seated needs. They want to be perhaps improve their relationship status, because right now maybe they're not in a good relationship because they feel unattractive, and so on. So there are this is what they're coming to you with. And so often you see these appeals on a website that don't address that at all. You'll get there and you'll see a button that says subscribe now or something like that, that is not really related to what the customer wants to do. And maybe the text on the page isn't really all that closely related either, or the imagery. So you've got to first align with that gravity, and you can do that on a conscious level. You can say, do you want to lose weight? So that would be a conscious thing, the way you're appealing to it.
Sure.
But also perhaps showing a happy couple in an image could deal with that sort of non-conscious desire to improve one's relationship status. The nudge is what happens at the top of the slide when you've got a little kid at the top on that little platform there. Either mom or dad has to give them a shove, or they have to push with their arms a little bit to get moving down the slide. And that can be anything. That could be pop-up. It could be a very visible call to action on a page, you know, a big red button. It could be in other contexts, a sales call. It could be a phone call, an email in somebody's inbox. All of these things can be nudges, and they really have to do only two things. They have to get the individual's attention, and they have to start that motivation process. If a nudge can exist, but it doesn't motivate at all, then nothing happens. And one example that I use occasionally is an ad where LinkedIn, to this day, they've been doing it for years, and they still do it. They will sometimes put your photo from your profile in an ad over on in another part of the page. So you're looking at this page of LinkedIn, and suddenly you see your photo over in the right-hand margin. You know, that. And you pretty much have to look to see what it's doing over there. I mean, it's a very effective nudge. I would say it gets the attention of 100%, or maybe not 100%, because some people just won't see it, but very effective at getting people's attention. Then when you look at it, you should follow Comcast. And it's like, okay, why should I follow Comcast? I'm not even in Comcast territory. They've given me zero reason to follow Comcast. So that's a nudge with no motivation, where, you know, if instead there had been some messaging showing that, you know, why it would save me money, make my life better, do something, then that would have gotten me going farther down the slide. And then the angle of the slide is the motivation that you're providing. And typically you need both conscious and non-conscious motivators. Even if you're focused on these sort of emotional appeals, you still often need some features or benefits or price type things simply to satisfy the customer's conscious mind. So if I go buy a the red convertible. Come home with a red convertible. I still need to explain to my friends that I didn't buy it because I was having a midlife crisis or whatever. But in fact, that car, based on my research, really holds its resale value better than other models. It gets great gas mileage and so on. I've got some ammunition to work with, even though I did not really buy it because of its better gas mileage or better resale value. The thing that is often overlooked is friction. You know, every year there are $4 trillion left in abandoned e-commerce shopping carts. Now, there's a lot of reasons for that. Sometimes people have to put stuff in there just to see what it costs with shipping or other reasons. That really, that's a whole other topic right there, why you should force people to do that. But often it's because they responded to perhaps an ad on Google. They clicked through, they shopped around the site, they put one or more items in their cart they were intended to buy, and then they got to the order form, and they look, and there's a big pile of stuff you have to fill out for the ship-to address and the bill-to address, and you've got to get your credit card out, and you've got to physically pull it out to look at that little number on the back to see what that is, because there's a spot for that in their form that they won't let you check out if you don't have the little code number, and people just give up. That is a high friction process. And if you compare that to what Amazon does, if you're a logged in Prime customer, they give you the ability to buy the item with one click. You know where it's going. You know which card it'll be charged to, because, for instance, you can have a home address and a business address. And if you're separating your costs that way, it is so simple and friction free that it's actually dangerous. I mean, it's just too easy to see something that you buy, you like, and just click that button without even thinking about it. That's conscious friction. When you've got a form that has a whole bunch of fields, I even see that in lead generation activities where somebody's just trying to get contacts for their sales force, and they put all this extraneous information in there where the form will have company name and title and timing of your need and, you know, all these questions that every one of those is going to dissuade more people from completing the form and getting to the end of the process. Mm-hmm. But the other kind of friction is non-conscious friction. And even things like the font that you use to put your directions in can be an element of friction by making things look more difficult, even though they're not. The colors that you use, reverse type, where you have light type on a white background, is less fluent, less cognitively fluent than more traditional black type on a white background. And that difficulty translates into perceived difficulty of whatever you're asking the customer to do. So there's been some great research on that. Adam Alter did an experiment which at confession site. This is a website where people go to post the horrible things they did that they're not willing to confess to. They analyze them before and after a design change, where initially it was a very disfluent site. It was kind of hard to read light type on a black background. And they switched then to a much easier to read black on white design. And what they found was that people's confessions, they analyzed thousands of confessions, and their confessions were far more revealing after the change, that the more fluent site put the customers more in mind to comply with their request to say, you know, tell us the bad things that you did. In another case, scientists at University of Minnesota asked people to estimate how long it would take to perform a simple exercise. It was like two sentences talking about putting your chin down in your chest and holding it there and repeating 6 to 10 times. Very simple little exercise. And two groups of people saw it. The first group saw it in Arial, a very simple, easy-to-read font. And they said it would take about 8 minutes to do these exercises. Mm-hmm. The second group saw it in a brushy font, which is exact same text, but just a little bit harder to read, perfectly legible. You wouldn't have any problem reading it. That group estimated it would take 15 minutes, almost twice as long, based just on the font. So, this is what I call either imaginary friction or perceived friction, where these design choices that may actually be delegated to a graphic designer who was just going to pick something that looks kind of cool, could have a really huge impact on the persuasion process. So that's, to me, that if people are trying to improve their results and not necessarily spend a lot of money, because you can always improve your results by spending money. If you give people free shipping, they'll buy more stuff. If you drop your prices 25%, they'll buy more stuff. Mm-hmm. But if you're looking to do it in a more cost-effective way, eliminating friction of all types, whether it's real or even this imaginary or perceived friction, mm-hmm. Is the cheapest thing you can do, because it really doesn't cost you anything at all. And then also looking at your motivation. By applying the right kind of motivation, you can use, particularly these non-conscious motivators, tend to be simply changes in your text or in your imagery that, again, really don't cost you anything compared to offering discounts or shipping deals and so on.
I want to ask a question about writing itself, but before I do, I want to ask another question about a concern I have with the concept of a formulaic approach that you're describing to us, that there is a better way to do it, that we need to be, you know, we need to worry about fuzzy typefaces. And here's my question, you know, do you worry that we'll learn too much about how to persuade people, and the words that we write and the design that we have will become too programmatic and, if you will, not human and possibly not filled with these elements of surprise that are important to us as we navigate around the web and the world to buy things?
No, you know, I really don't worry about that too much. I think that, first of all, we've had some very smart people persuading people for decades. You know, look at the great ad agencies going back to the 60s, and you know, they knew something about persuasion. And in fact, people raise the same question or similar question with neuromarketing. When you start putting people in fMRI machines or whatever, you know, wow, are you going to be able to take over their brain somehow?
Yeah, right.
And the quick answer is no. If there was a way of taking over people's brains and getting them to do stuff that they didn't want to do, somebody would have figured it out years ago without the benefit of these tools. Really what I see is we have the opportunity to eliminate a lot of bad communication. Not so much that we're going to create these super powerful means of communication, but that we're going to eliminate some of the bad stuff. I mean, how many times have you watched a TV commercial? Less of these days with fast forward, but the and couldn't even recall who what the ad was for, who ran it, or that it was so bad that you actually changed channels or muted it or something to get rid of it. If we can identify and improve the worst stuff to make it at least somewhat palatable, I think that'll be a big service.
You'll enjoy obsession that Josh Burnoff is going to be featuring one of our keynotes at Content Marketing Conference. He's writing a book now, and it's going to be releasing this year, called Without the Bullshit. and I don't know if you know. Do you know Josh Burnoff?
I don't.
He wrote a book called Groundswell. He was a co-author of that, and he's been at Forrester Research for about 25 years. He just retired from Forrester, and now he's writing and publishing, and he's a really interesting guy, Josh Burnoff. But I wanted to go back to my original question, which is writing. We've got so many wonderful writers on the line tuning in and listen to this. You know, so I work with writers at Writer Access myself, and I've done a lot of speaking on a topic that's near and dear to me, and that's how to make content what I call snap, crackle, and pop. Content snaps when readers quickly understand the value and why it matters, and it crackles when readers smile and laugh and react in some emotional, very important way, and content pops when it inspires and motivates people to take action. How do you, first of all, do you agree with the concept that it is possible to create content that has what I call snap, crackle, and pop? And second of all, do you think that's something that people can learn how to do, particularly with the help of testing and to see what works and what doesn't work?
Sure. Well, first of all, I think it's I should compliment you on your little metaphor there, because you are doing a few good things with that. not only are you using a metaphor, but it's a slogan that probably 99% of your listeners are familiar with.
Yeah.
So you're sort of piggybacking onto that slogan with your somewhat more complex message about what content should be or what copy should be like. So that's a great start. As far as can this technique be learned, I would certainly think so. I'm not an expert on writing, but there are very few skills possessed by humans that cannot be improved through training and practice and feedback. And, the different types of activities may require a different mix of those elements, but certainly being able to get feedback on whether something worked or whether it didn't work can be both sort of codified by the person who's directly getting that experience, but also then it may be able to be developed into a greater rule that can be communicated to many people if one keeps finding a similar result.
Yeah, sort of like the definition.
It should be both an experience-based and a training-based.
Let's go back to the book. Who did you really craft your book for? Who's the right target audience for your book?
Well, Brainfluence is written for marketers in general and really anybody who is interested in the brain and psychology and how persuasion works. The persuasion slide book is crafted a little bit more for marketers who want to go to the next level in that persuasion process and really think about how to incorporate the conscious and non-conscious elements. And because, again, I saw there's so much content being created out there, you can't pick up or read a blog that's about conversion or e-commerce without finding maybe, 10 or 20 or 30% of the content being somehow based on psychology. And this is, it's an interesting read for people, but they need a way of sort of organizing all this. And that was my intention there. So the persuasion slide is really more for the content creators, the marketers who are formulating messages, designing ads, designing landing pages and websites and apps and that sort of thing.
Terrific. Well, it's been great having you on today. I've enjoyed this conversation very much, which is probably why it lasted so long. We might have to make this a two-part series or something. But thank
great.
You.
Well, yeah, it's been a lot of fun, Byron.
Roger, thank you so much for listening in with us. Appreciate it.
Well, thanks for inviting me, Byron.
Right on. Hope everybody enjoyed the conversation today. We'll look forward to chatting with you next week. Thanks for tuning in, everybody.
Thanks for listening and happy writing. You can join us each week for a new podcast. Check out Writer Podcasts on Stitcher, iTunes, and our website, writeraccess.com.